Chapter 26, A Chip Off the Old Block. A quick look back at the 1800s and early 1900s will reveal a marked increase in the number of people that exhibited the features of neurological dysfunction. Even a cursory glance through the medical literature of that time will highlight the rise. New illnesses like neuralgia or Alzheimer's appeared, and facilities meant to deal with them followed close behind. In the United States, nervine rest centers and mental institutions began to spring up throughout the country. Homes were built with fainting rooms, spaces dedicated to the recovery and restoration of females overcome with hysteria or other unexplained neurological phenomena. Massive asylums began to dot the landscape, beautiful buildings with 100-acre campuses designed to give their residents a break from the rigors of modern life. An existence so distressful it could create the fatigue, phantom pains, and foggy-headedness of what they called Americanitis. In hindsight, it appears the rise in medicinal metals like mercury and arsenic probably had more to do with the explosion of neurological illness of this time than the horseless carriage or electricity, inventions whose arrivals were thought to have contributed to the problem. Physicians employed specific terms to categorize the sick. Feeble-minded, idiot, imbecile, moron. These labels sound hurtful to the modern ear, but at the time were medical terms employed freely with little fear of offense. As more asylums were filled and new ones were built, doctors, their medicine bags brimming with mercuric calomel and arsenical Fowler's solution, struggled to explain the rise. The collision of two schools of thought would give them the answer they were looking for. In the Austrian Empire, Gregor Mendel was conducting experiments on plants, mice, honeybees, and anything else that would readily reproduce in his lab. His focus was genetics, an exciting field of science that promised to explain why the traits of certain parents were sometimes passed on to their offspring, while other times were ignored. During the same period, the temperance movement was gaining widespread adoption, and demonstrations, parades, and processions were being held in much of the United States to call attention to the dangers of alcohol consumption. Not content with curtailing beer, wine, and whiskey, many adherents of the temperance movement pressed forward to promote the religious and health benefits of a chaste life. As a result, the puritanical lifestyle became in vogue. These two notions would combine to form the chief suspect in the rise of neurological disorders of the day. It was the parents that were giving birth to children that would later go on to develop mental illness, and not just any parents, men and women living in sin, unmarried, and likely consuming too much alcohol. Put simply, unchaste parents begot mentally deficient children. With little to no awareness of fetal alcohol syndrome, this assumption may have been based in part on reality. Parents that were alcoholics often did give birth to children with neurological problems. But the doctors of the day extrapolated far beyond any actual correlation and insisted that unfit mothers and fathers and their randy behavior were often the cause of intellectually deficient offspring. The disfigured brains of asylum patients, while remarkable, were assumed to have been inherited from one, if not both, of their parents. Insanity, feeble-mindedness, and all other flavors of mental illness were thought to be hereditary, and as a result, asylums and nervine rest homes were designed with aggressive gender separation to avoid the inadvertent creation of yet more mentally disabled children. As asylums continued to spring up, complex hereditary charts were drawn, illustrating how if both parents had a nervous temperament, it was likely the mother would give birth to a feeble-minded child. In fact, scientists were confused when in 1912, the Hill Folk study found that, quote, in the number of matings which occurred between two definitely feeble-minded persons, the proportion of defective offspring was not 100%, as should have been expected, but only 77.3%. The widespread assumption that genetics was playing a large part in the rise of the mentally ill led to a dark chapter, one of many, in medical history. The numbers of patients requiring institutional care was on the rise, and it was assumed if these adults were not prevented from procreating, the problem would only get worse. In 1911, quote, a resolution was adopted appointing a committee to study and report on the best practical means of cutting off the defective germ plasm in the American population, end quote. With the specter of a nation full of poisoned imbeciles hanging over their head, doctors and public health officials undertook aggressive compulsory sterilization programs. Men and women suspected of having a mental disorder, likely caused by the very medicines physicians had administered, were forced to undergo operations that would prevent them from having children. It was just as this obsession with genetics as a cause for mental illness had peaked that parents in America and Austria began to bring their children to Connor and Asperger's offices, anxious to understand what had happened to them. Undoubtedly, their mothers and fathers cut a strange figure for doctors who had long believed that intellectually deficient children were the result of mentally deficient parents. It was not enough that the distinct characteristics of autism had never been seen before. There appeared to be absolutely no history of feeble-mindedness or insanity, indeed, not even a shade of nervous temperament that so many women of that era seemed to possess. The temperance movement and its descendants would have had no quarrel with any of these parents, but it was more than that. These weren't just good people. These were exceptional people, doctors, nurses, lawyers. This disconnect caused a great amount of confusion. The eugenics and forced sterilizations of previous decades had fallen out of favor, but the assumption that mental illness was inherited from one's parents remained. Autism was something different. It had appeared seemingly from nowhere, and the parents of those affected were remarkably healthy, mentally stable, and showed no signs of anything amiss they might pass on to their children. Despite the promise of Mendel's discoveries, autism was not playing by the rules. There were no autistic mothers or fathers filling the asylums or mental institutions across the United States or Austria, eugenic fugitives from sterilization programs meant to prevent their having any offspring. There were only the children, and no one had a clue as to why. It wasn't just the obvious lack of heredity that served to confuse. There was something else equally puzzling about the children with autism, another trait that neither Connor nor Asperger had seen before. Some of the children, not all of them, but some, over time, were improving.